You really?
It's only telling me share desktop. Oh, wait a minute. Yeah, I see it. Press on that.
Yeah.
I press on that.
Press on that, yes.
Okay, it's on.
Okay.
Okay, it's on.
And we'll talk.
I did it.
Okay, because that's something I think once, you know, if you do get here or whenever, we can walk you through some of the training that we talked about before. Please join me in saying the Anabakoa.
Okay.
Anabakoa. Pray Cheyenne, Sintet Nun. Na Gibor, Dor Sheyehud Cha, Kevavad Shamrein. Nun Gibel Dalet, Yud Kaf Shin. Barchem Tacharem, Rakame Sit Karcha, Ta. Amid Gamlem Betet Resh Sadi Taf Gimel. The Kaf, the letter that created the sun, which is known as both the Shemesh and the Chatan. The outer level is hot. The inner level is that of a servant. And we have to remember to constantly strive to become the servants of all of our friends. Chasin Kadosh Berov Tuvcha Nael Adatach Chetkuvbet Tet Nunayim Yachid Gaya Lamcha Pene Zobre Kedu Shatach Yud Gimel Lamed Pei Zayin Kuf Shavatenu Kabel Ushma Tziakatenu Yodea Talulot Shinkuvav Sadiyutta. And the eighth verse we say silently. We are continuing our study of the secrets of the third temple by Rabbi Chaim Luzzatto, translated by the organization of Zamru.org. And I believe we're at the curtain before the entrance to the Holy of Holies was the last place we left off. Before the entrance to the Holy of Holies hangs a great curtain of exactly the same width and height as the entrance, neither more nor less. Let me explain the purpose of this curtain. It was formed by several lights which joined together here to prevent anything that should not pass through from so doing. The two great constellations bring about all things at all times. The constellations, they're using the word mazalot, coming from mazal, the flow. And they themselves include all 13 of the great springs known to the wise, namely the 13 attributes of mercy. No man could ever stand in the face of their great radiance and holiness. All are in fear and trembling, lest they be consumed in the great fire. After them, seven great and wondrous names hold sway. These are the four main extensions of the Tetragrammaton, 72, 63, 45, 52, belonging to the upper mazal, and the three main expressions of Echie, 161, 151, and 143, belonging to the lower mazal. It is from all these lights joined together that this curtain, the Hebrew word is parochet, is formed. The numerical value of these letters of parochet, pei, resh, kaf, taf, 100, corresponding to these seven names, and the 13 attributes of mercy. Pei is 80, resh 200, kaf 20, taf 400, equals 700, which is equal to the 232 plus the 455 plus the 13. Ari, are you there? Do you hear me?
Yes, do you hear me?
I do, but I don't see you. Is your camera off?
No, I don't have a... The camera doesn't work at this point. I'm going to have to get a new one.
All right, no problem. When I put you on the twice now, I've kicked Chris off. Chris, welcome to Ari. Ari is in Chicago. Chris is in Oregon. And Ari is joining us for the first time. He's never heard me unless... I don't know, Ari, have you heard me on any of the recordings from the Yeshem site? Ari, are you there?
Can you hear me?
I can hear you now, yes.
Okay, here, we're good. No, I was, I just got back from out of town. I was taking some comprehensive exams down in Tuscaloosa at the University of Alabama Law School for the last day and a half. I'm in an LLM program, Master's of Law program in taxation there. We do the same kind of classes like we're doing here. So, but once a year, you got to go down there.
I hear you. Well, welcome back home.
Thank you.
We got started a few minutes ago. We're studying the book, The Secrets of the Third Temple by Rabbi Chaim Luzzatto.
All right.
It's available online at the azamra.org website. We're in this section called Building. It's actually chapter one, I believe, after
right.
Introduction. And we're on the section called The Curtain Before the Entrance to the Holy of Holies. And I actually did this the last time, the last session. But as I'm reading it now, because the last time I was a little tired, as I'm reading it now, there's a lot of commentaries. I don't know if we'll ever get off this. But let's approach it. This whole idea of a curtain in the structure of the Sefirot, it's discussed in Etz Chaim, the sections, the book that Rabbi Chaim Vital wrote on the teachings of the Ari. But it's very that book is difficult to understand. And Rabbi Ashlag in the 20th century took the Etz Chaim and reorganized it and made his commentary. It's titled the Esther Sefirot, 10 Luminous Emanations. And I teach that class Wednesday nights at 7 p.m. If you ever want to join us. We just started, so there's only two classes into that. But in the Esther Sefirot, Rabbi Ashlag explains the idea of a curtain, why it's a curtain. Why is there a curtain in front of the Holy of Holies? But it's really, why is there a curtain in front of our world? As we know, Malchut receives no light of its own. It has no light of its own. The process of receiving from the Creator, He sends us all this energy. He sends us all of this love, all of this goodness, because that's what the idea of creation was, to give, well, to be revealed, and then as in exchange for that revelation, to send goodness to his creation. So he sends this, but because of the deal, and it's too long for us to get into it in this, or we never get out of this section, he sends us this goodness, but we are unable to receive it because there can be no light in Malchut that has not been earned from a concept called bread of shame. And the question is, why not a window? Why not a door? Why a curtain? And that's so that the taste, that light, that goodness can come in. But if it is not earned, it cannot be kept. And that's why we get, you sit in a new car, and you have that wonderful new smell. And everybody loves that wonderful new smell. But it goes away after a few weeks, a few months. Why does it go away? It's because of this curtain. That we receive this wonderfulness, but if we didn't earn it, it goes away. The way to earn it is called restriction, and in my basic class I go into that. It's called binding by striking is the Hebrew translation, direct translation of the Hebrew. But that whole idea, and that is why in front of the Holy of Holies is this curtain. And Rabbi Luzzatto is mentioning it here, but not really explaining it. The next paragraph that he talks about is he's bringing these mazalot, and he's explaining how we get Yudke Vavke. And it's a very technical aspect, but it's something that you should understand in order to grow in Kabbalah. The letter Yud has a gematria of 10. Whenever you either see a Yud in the writings or you say a Yud in your talk, in your speech, you are also concealing two other letters. The full spelling out of the letter Yud, which is Vav Dalet. So Yud is spelled Yud Vav Dalet. Hey, when it's spelled out, can be spelled out with a yud, so it's hey yud, or it can be spelled out hey hey, or it can be spelled out hey aleph. The vav can be spelled out vav yud vav, vav aleph vav, or vav vav. And the final hey, like the first hey. These difference in the spelling out gives rise to different numerical values. One of those numerical values is 72, and that is the level of Chokmah, the level of wisdom. Another of these spelling outs is 63, and that's the level of Binah. Another level is 45, which coincidentally, and I'm joking when I say coincidentally, 45 is the numerical value of the word Adam, which means man, in addition to the first man named Adam. Adam represents Zeron Pin. It represents Kadosh Baruch Hu in the typical writing of the Kabbalist. Another way of spelling out the Tetragrammaton is 52. Which represents Malchut. So you have the four levels of the Tetragrammaton. Rabbi Luzzatto is explaining all of this is built into the context of the curtain. That happens to be, those four numbers happen, coincidentally again, to total 232. Now, in the Sefer Yetzirah, we'll discuss in that class the whole discussion that there's 231 gates. Gates represent two letters, or the 22 letters, times 21 letters, which is the way the all of the total combinations that you can get from 22 letters is 231 gates. 232 with a kolel, with the additional one that we add in gematria because of the connection to the higher levels. 232 happens to be the gematria of the word Baruch. Happens to be, coincidentally. I'm sorry to use these words. Now, when we get to the idea of Echie, the same thing applies. An Aleph is spelled Aleph Lamed Pei. The He, as we said before, there's three different ways of spelling it. The Yud, Yud Vav Dalet, and then the final He. So those spelling outs relate to these numbers. 161, the numerical value of the last of the 13th attributes of mercy, the Nake, an aspect of cleansing. 151 is the numerical value of mikveh. What's the difference between mikveh and vinakeh is 10, the number 10. But that actually represents the 10 sefirot, a completion act that is greater than that of a mikveh, a level of cleansing up to the level of chokmah. I'm not familiar with the number 143, but I'm sure there is a connection as part of this. Now we have this numerical value of the curtain itself, which Rabbi Luzzatto is telling us is 700. And 700 represents the seven lower sefirot in the level of Binah. And this is what the curtain is representing, the agreement that was made in the endless world so that we cannot receive fulfillment unless we have earned it. This is the agreement that we made. Why is too long to go into. Feel free to ask questions as we go along. The Ark of Testimony. Behind the curtain, inside the Holy of Holies, stands the Ark of Testimony, testifying to the inseparable hidden unity of God. The Ark stands on the foundation stone for reasons that will be clear on the basis of what I explained in the introduction. I'm surprised that they didn't tell us what was the Hebrew word that they're translating as God, because that is very important. Whenever you are reading a Kabbalistic text that's been translated, you need to know many of the terms, what was the Hebrew, so that you can understand the relationships. The candelabra...
That's true, Rabbi, because...
Go ahead.
The reason is, I mean, you know, you have Elohim, of course, and that can be problematic, and El and the rest of them. So how do we go about, you know, working with that? You know, is it a lexicon that we use or what?
Well, if you're talking from the Torah, you can use a lexicon. But,
okay.
You know, typically a good translation will specify it. If you don't know, get the original in Hebrew and look up the word. Even if you don't read Hebrew,
yep.
You don't know Hebrew, I don't speak Hebrew. I wouldn't say that I'm conversant in Hebrew, and yet, you know, I do that. I will go to the original text and take a look at the words and translate them word by word. I have a program that's a dictionary called WordPoint that, you know, can give me like 50 different languages. one of which is Hebrew, and you take a look at the words and you get a sense of what the verse is saying, what the sentence is saying, but you'll be able to identify which name of God is being translated as God. And it is necessary to know that.
Right.
Because it also helps you know.
Absolutely.
Because the Torah itself is written, is actually a full structure of the universe as it relates to the Sephirot. Now, obviously, we don't read it that way. Maybe the Kabbalists are on a consciousness level to know that, to read it that way. Rabbi Ashlag hints that he was able to do so. But he speaks about the language of the Sephirot as opposed to the language of branches, as opposed to the simple stories. All of these are different levels of understanding Torah. And this applies to every Kabbalistic text that you will ever read. They're always on these different levels of language. And in order to know which level, which sphere you're on, you need to know what is the name of God.
Right.
In the sanctuary are three great precious lights, one to the right, one to the left, and one in the center, serving both sides at once. Let me explain these three lights. The light on the right side spread out in all its strength and glory, appearing as a candelabrum, a menorah, made entirely of gold with seven great lamps extending on both sides. This light comes from the upper Shekhinah, for it is here in the sanctuary that she reveals her power, since this is the place where all the souls are rectified. As you will see later when we discuss the sacrifices, why are her lights seven in number? Because she is on the seventh level, counting from above.
Rabbi, I had a quick question on that.
By the way, Ari, I'm not a rabbi, so my name is Hanukkah,
okay.
And feel free to call
me. I'm used to it. All right. I got a question on that. Wouldn't that seven, when the seven comes up, and as you know, I've got astrological experience with this, wouldn't that refer to the seven luminaries of the ancient times? Is there an indirect reference when we see this?
No, it's a direct reference.
That's what I thought. Okay.
The seven luminaries of the ancient times represent the planets that could physically be seen from the world, from the earth.
Okay.
Now, the seven luminaries are channels for the Sephirot, the lower seven left Sephirot.
Okay.
Now, historically, nobody ever said, because the Kabbalists have no reason to reveal this to people who were not knowledgeable, and those who were knowledgeable realized it for themselves. But essentially, all of the planets in the solar system were known. But the energy of the Keter, Chachma, and Bina, of Pluto, Neptune, and Uranus, was channeled through the other seven Sephirot. So they did not need to deal with that in the astrology. As we get closer to the end times, the discovery, meaning the magnifying, the telescope has discovered these planets. The reason for that, Kabbalistically, is we need to implement that into our astrology and understand that these planets are now going direct. But
right.
I'm not comfortable with the way the Western astrologers deal with that. And it's not yet revealed clearly enough for us to utilize it in the Hebrew astrology. But
with the Hebrew astrology,
let me finish. Just like we have letters that are normal letters, we have letters that are end letters, Sofit letters. So you'll have a Kaf Sofit and the Mem Sofit and the Nun Sofit and so forth. That letter represents both energies, the energy of the normal times and the energy of the end times. that, and their numerical values are different in the gematria. And that's the same idea of the other planets. But when you ask the question about the seven luminaries, the seven sephirot, there is a direct connection. Which one is which? We don't need to go into right now.
Right. All right. The question that I was thinking of is, you know, you have retrograde planets with a geocentric system. With a heliocentric system, of course, you don't have retrograding planets. Does Kabbalah deal more from a heliocentric or a geocentric interpretation?
Both terms I understand from my engineering background, but I'm not really familiar with them as dealing with the astrology. I will say the one impact that I found meaningful in the astrology is that Venus rotates opposite of every other planet. So, but I'm not familiar with the Western astrology dealing with those two geo, what was it, geo something and helio something?
Yeah, in other words, when they construct a chart, which is typically geocentric, because our orbit pattern varies with other planets' orbit patterns,
right,
there are times in which the planets will appear as though they're going backwards, and
right,
the ancients knew this. In fact, they don't really do that, although there is an interpretation given to that, generally being that things go backwards. Things get delayed. There's all kinds of, depending upon what constellation that occurs in, and usually that's anywhere from 21 to 24 days, three, sometimes four times a year.
Right.
But
I'm familiar with retrograde concepts. And
if you're dealing with the
Hebrew astrology.
Okay. So in other words, we're looking whereas heliocentric would be as though we were living on the sun, and we would never see retrograding planets simply because there would be no variation in planetary orbits. You would simply see them as they are. So that's why I raised that question.
Okay. Now that you've explained what they are specifically, I can tell you that the only one that we would deal with in Kabbalah assumes that we're on the Earth, because the Earth is the center of the universe. The purpose
right.
of creation okay. was man. Man lives on the Earth until he chooses to
right.
leave and go elsewhere in this universe, whether he does so physically or he does so spiritually, that remains to be seen. But man,
right? I mean, in fact,
go ahead.
In fact, then, you know, we're dealing always with, you know, both temporal and spiritual here, as being Earth is the center, and you know, what actually, in fact, happens scientifically is a little bit different from the standpoint of science, considering the sun is center.
Correct.
Okay.
Eventually, science will catch up and understand that the Earth is the center, but in it, you know, the sun represents Tiferet, the center of the tree of life. So there is a reason why they're perceiving it the way they are.
Okay.
Continuing. The light on the right side spread out in all its strength and glory, appearing as a menorah, made entirely of gold with seven great lamps extending on both sides. This light comes from the upper Shekhinah, for it is here, in the sanctuary, that she reveals her power, since this is the place where all the souls are rectified. As you will see later when we discuss the sacrifices, why are her lights seven in number? Because she is on the seventh level counting from above. In essence, she is Malchut. The Shekhinah is Malchut. She is the level of manifestation. She is the level of our physical world. But you always need to be unclear on what frame of reference you are referring to when you use the name of a Sephirah. because a Sephirah can be Malchut of Zeranpin, of Bina, of Keter, of Malchut, because there is no limits to the way the Sephirah go within. Every Sephirot has 10 Sephirot within it, and each of those have 10 Sephirot, and each of those have 10 Sephirot, infinitely. And we always need to know the frame of reference we are referring to, or we'll get lost and confused. Likewise, to the left there is a single light that extends along and across in the form of a table set with all manner of dainties. The showbread is on this table at all times. The table is 2 cubits long and 3 cubits high, making a total of 5. This is the light coming forth from the lower Shekhinah, since she is 5th counting down from the levels above her. Her measure is 5. 3 of these 5 levels join together, while the 4th, Yesod, does not separate from Malchut. This is why the dimensions of the table are 3 by 2. I'm not understanding this idea of a 5th down from the levels. That would be Hod. Okay. I do understand it. It's interesting to what's being shown in this. It's really amazing. The menorah represents Malchut. And I believe it's in the north, but it's not said here. And the table with the showbread, with the astrological influences, which is what the showbread represent, the 12 showbreads represent the mazalot, that's showing us to be Hod, which is on a higher level. But Hod represents Malchut in the spiritual frame. So you can understand why they need to be in the same place of the sanctuary. Between these two lights, the candelabrum and the table, stands a third serving both of them. This is called the inner or the incense altar, where the sacrifice of the souls of Israel is offered, as I will explain later. These three lights are talking about the three columns of the tree of life. Wood and gold lining on the walls. When the sanctuary stood with all its walls in place, according to their correct measurements, a lining appeared inside, covering the walls from top to bottom. Over it appeared a second lining. Let me explain the secret of these linings. The walls themselves are built of stones which come from Malchut. Over them hovers the glory of the king, which completely covers them so that they are invisible. This lining is made of wood because it comes from the tree of life. Covering it is a second lining, which is much more splendid than both the stones and the wood. This second lining derives from Bina, which hides her children under her wings. It is therefore of pure gold. Let me now reveal a great secret. When all levels reach a state of rectification, and the holy union of lights gives rise to the most blissful tranquility, nothing is seen of Tiferet or Malchut, because Bina constantly hovers over them. As the verse says, like the eagle rouses his nest. The great glory hovering over them hides them from the eyes of all living. This is only fitting, for it says, go humbly before the Lord your God. This is why the Torah forbids placing wood in the lower temple unless it is covered with gold. This will help you understand the ways of God and see how deep and far removed they are from human wisdom. Let me give you a metaphor to expand on this in case it's not clear. When you have a light bulb in your hand and you look inside the light bulb, you'll see three components. You'll see a positive pole, a negative pole, and a wire, which we call the filament, stretching between them. There are three different components in that light bulb. Put it in a light and flip the switch, and you no longer see the three components. You just see light. Because the three components are no longer three. They've unified into one. This is the concept of the Ten Sefirot. And this is the criticism of the Kabbalah. Because how can you say there's one God when there's ten gods, God forbid, dealing with the Sefirot? And that's the understanding that's being explained right here. As the lights go on, the ten Sefirot unify. They're still there in potential, because if you turn the light off, they return. But there's separation and there's unification. And what is the difference is consciousness. Do you see ten Sefirot, or do you see the Tree of Life? Do you see five fingers on your hand, or do you see one hand? Do you see you and me, or do you see part singular of the Ein Sof vessel? It's all in consciousness. Cherubs and palms on the walls. Inside the sanctuary, the most beautiful lights appear on all the walls. They all receive from one another as they spread out from amidst the radiance caused by the perfect union all around. These lights shine in the form of cherubs and palm trees. Understanding the greatness and importance of these lights, there are male and female palms. Of this it is said, the tzaddik will flourish like the palm, referring to the tzaddik as Yesod and his mate as Malchut. The cherubs have two faces, that of a man on one side and that of the lion on the other. Know that the building of the temple is accomplished through the power of the right side in mercy. That's chesed, but it's chesed of Tiferet. This is the secret of the verse. The mountain of the house of Hashem will be firmly established on the top of the mountains. The top of the mountains alludes to the right side, that of the lion, of which it is said, and the face of the lion to the right, from Ezekiel. This joins with Adam, man, corresponding to Tiferet, or Zeranpin, the center column. It is from the light of these two that the holy union symbolized by the palm tree derives. For this reason, the faces of the cherubs are turned towards the palm trees. For the lion is on one side, the face of the man on the other, and the palm tree stands between the two. Again, referring to the three columns. But also, we have a tradition that the cherubs that are on the ark, and I'm not clear whether this is referring to the ark. I don't think it is. This is referring to the third temple. But in our first and second temple, or in our first temple, because we didn't have the ark in the second temple. In the first temple, we had the ark, and when the Jewish people were in unity with Hashem, when they were doing their work, their spiritual work, when they were not making the mistakes that unfortunately we made, they would be facing each other. Now, these are a solid gold piece, you know, a solid piece of gold, but they would be facing each other. And when the Jewish people were outside, were doing things incorrectly, were separating from the Creator, they would be turned away from each other. This was a tradition that is taught that actually, when the temple was destroyed, as the walls were burning, the cherubs on the ark were facing each other, to show that the beginning includes the end. The appearance of the beginning was, we're separated. We've screwed up. We've made this mess, and the effect is the temple has to be taken away from us. And yet the outcome of the temple being lost is the restoration of the temple, which is the manifestation of the union of the Jewish people with the Creator. It's really a lovely midrash. Any questions?
Rabbi, I just had one real quick question. When we talk about midrash, we're talking about interpretation, but there's another term we use, and I just can't remember it, so that if I were to shed new light or a different, offer a different facet to a particular a passage, what do we call that?
Before I answer your question, I have to express an exception to your first statement. And it's not a criticism, it's a disagreement in understanding. Midrash is not interpretation. The Reform movement, much of the conservative movement, perceives Midrash as a lower level than the Tanakh itself. And okay. So they describe it as interpretation. There can be a Midrash that it directly refutes and is exactly the opposite of another Midrash. And people don't know how to reconcile these two Midrashim. The Kabbalists teach us that all Midrash, like all prophecies, come from different levels. So they're not interpretation. They are part of Torah, an aspect of Torah, one of the 10 levels of Torah. So I don't mean to disagree with you. I do understand where you're coming from, and so I'm not critical of it. Just from the standpoint, I want to point out those differences so that you'll understand my answer a bit.
Oh, okay.
I think the word you're looking for is allegorical, but I'm not real sure.
Well, say I were to say, okay, this is, we have a passage X, and passage X, Rashi, Ramban have said this is what I see it as being. But now I offer a third view, not necessarily in conflict with them, but something that seems to make sense, for example. What would you call that?
A synthesis. I would use the Marx expression, call it synthesis.
Okay.
It is in its unification. Because using the example that you gave, it's probably a better example to say that the Rambam says this and the Ramban says that. Well, the Rambam is coming from the left column, and the Ramban is coming from the right column, and they need to be synthesized. They need to be unified, which is what the central column represents. that balance point that makes it all appear. That light, using the metaphor that I used before, when you turn on the light, the separation disappears. That's what I would call it. I hope that was helpful.
Yes.
The narrow windows. These lights illuminated the entire sanctuary, filling it with blessing and favor. The palms and cherubs increased the strength of the welling stream of blessing, concentrated it in the sanctuary. Even as it goes forth from the presence of its masters, it does not weaken. As the intense light within the sanctuary burst outwards, not only did it open the gate, but also breached numerous apertures in the walls. Even though these apertures are very narrow on the inside, the light shining out from them spreads forth on all sides. For this reason, these apertures in the walls are called closed windows, because they are narrow on the inside and wide outside. Such apertures are found in all the walls of the sanctuary, the Holy of Holies, and the vestibules. Numerous lights shine forth from these windows at all times, in addition to the flow of blessing that goes forth from the gates. For the flow of blessing goes out only as its appointed times, whereas the lights from these windows never cease to shine, giving strength and power to the lower worlds. Moreover, even those who ascend to receive from the gates first go up to the windows. They look inside through the windows, seeing the intensity of light and joy inside. They are filled with rejoicing and yearn to delight in that hidden goodness. Their yearning and desire bring them running to the gate, exulting and singing praises. There they stand until their portion is given to them, each according to his share. By first gazing through the windows, their souls gain sufficient strength to withstand the intensity of the flow of blessing that comes forth from the gate. We're not talking about a window like I'm looking out a window right now at a pool, at a fountain in the pool, at green grass, at trees. It's not a window like we see it. A window is a place where the light can flow. But it's not the whole light, because not all of the light can penetrate the window. It has limitations. It has barriers. It has, I don't want to use the limitations is really a wrong term in this context. Boundaries. It has boundaries. A window is establishing the flow of light, but it's establishing its boundaries at the same time. In the temple, the first temple, the second temple, and also in the third temple, from what Rabbi Luzzatto is saying, the windows are built differently than we build windows in the physical world. In our windows, the outer frame of the window is narrower than the inner frame. In the temple, the opposite is true. And that's to show that the flow of light is not to show, bring light into the temple, but to bring light to the world. The Creator doesn't need the light. He already has the light. He sees everything. There's no need for sunlight to flow into the building. But there's definitely a need for the light of the Creator to flow into our world. there any other questions? Because we're about out of time.
I'm good, Rabbi, at this point. This is good. My technology works. Just a matter of getting a webcam back and so forth. It's a good start. So forth. We do meet tonight, correct?
Yes, tonight in an hour. In 2 hours, actually.
You know, actually, for me, it's 8 o'clock.
So
it would be 9 o'clock my time.
In 1 hour is when the class starts. In 1 hour,
okay.
The Sefer Yetzirah class starts. I will warn you that this is the, being the second class, what I'm going to be teaching will have very little direct connection to astrology. In this one class, the rest of the class do have it. But actually, this does have a lot to do with astrology, but it's part of the meditative technique to understand Hebrew astrology. But you'll see when you join the class tonight.
Okay.
Chris, how about you? What did you feel about today's lesson? I know it's, you know, you've been studying this stuff for a long time, and obviously Ari has some very direct background in astrology and other frames that you don't have. So what was your feeling about the session?
It's always a blessing to learn these secrets from the temple, because it gives you the explanation of what really goes on in the universe. And I find it very stimulating to be able to know these things. I look forward to more.
Baruch Hashem, Bezrat Hashem, with the help of God.
Yep.
Ari, please try and remember I'm not a rabbi. I know that's an important, you know, sign of respect, and I appreciate it. But a true rabbi has a spiritual level that I have yet to attain.
All right.
Have a beautiful day, you guys.
Yep, and I'll see you at 9.
I'll see both of you at 9. Chris never misses a class.
Very good. Thanks very much then, Chinook.
Bye-bye.